This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to Indian Religions here on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. More importantly, I have the pleasure today of speaking with Dr. Kusumita Peterson, who is Professor Emerita of Religious Studies at St. Francis College. She's also chair at the Interfaith Center of New York, along with a variety of positions that she holds. She's a very active woman. Today, we're focusing on her brand new 2021 Lexington book, The Philosophy of Sri Chinmoy, Love and Transformation. Kusumita, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Raj, for having me today.
My pleasure. Now, first question, some may know exactly what your book is about. Some may wonder, rather broad question, but Sri Chinmoy, who is the Sri Chinmoy figure that you're writing about?
Sri Chinmoy is my spiritual teacher. He was born in Chittagong, East Bengal, now Bangladesh, in 1931. And he passed away in 2007. He, as a child, at age 12, when both of his parents had passed away, went to become a resident of the Sri Aurobindo Ashram in Pondicherry, South India. And in 1964, he left Pondicherry and came to live in New York City. And he invariably, in answering questions, said that this was a directive from the divine within him. He would say his inner pilot, or the supreme, called him to come to the West, and specifically New York, to share what he had realized through years of very profound practice of meditation and yoga. So, and he wrote very, very extensively. He gave lectures. He answered hundreds, if not thousands, of questions. He wrote thousands of poems. And even wrote some plays and short stories. And so my book is only the first chapter of my book is biographical. And I forgot to say that after settling in New York in 1964, he lived here. I also live in New York for the rest of his life, but traveled widely. So only the first chapter of my book is his biography. But if people would like to know, well, who is Sri Chinmoy, which is your question, the first chapter gives a kind of historical account. And then the rest of the book is a summary of his thought. And we're using the word philosophy, not as specifically as it's used in these times as modern academic philosophy as practiced in universities, especially in the West, but in the ancient sense of the love of wisdom and search for the ultimate, as it was known in the Greco-Roman world. And we could talk more about that.
He certainly is a fascinating and prolific figure. It's actually astonishing the amount he was able to produce, the amount of poems, the amount of writings, hundreds or thousands of published pieces. So his output is voluminous. And what this book does is it distills what he has to say on various important topics. Do you want to say a word about the layout of the book or the name of the names of the subsequent chapters beyond the first chapter?
Sure. I should say I'm trained in philosophy and theology, and also in the as a historian of religions. So I did my doctorate at Columbia in Buddhist studies. I was, you know, rigorously trained to work historically from primary sources, but I've always had a very profound interest in normative theological and philosophical questions and constructive work in philosophy and theology. So it seemed to me very clear that the order of the topics should be as follows, and they are after the biographical chapter, which is called From Shakyamuni to the World. The subsequent chapters are God, the nature of God, creation and evolution, the soul's journey, which discusses reincarnation and the evolutionary process, knowledge and realization, it's the epistemological chapter, and talks about the knowledge that's acquired through yoga, love. Sri Chinmoy always described his path as the path of love, devotion, and surrender. And then finally, the final chapter is called Acceptance and Transformation. A core theme in his work is acceptance of the world and the practice of spirituality and yoga as a means of transforming the world, not just the individual.
There are a number of themes of his philosophy that I might like to touch on in our conversation. But the first that comes to mind is, I teach online at a few different places, but in particular at the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies. And, you know, the word God, I was saying in a tutorial, I think earlier this week, probably not the first time I've found myself saying this. I said, you know, very much in our context, in my particular context, in North America in particular, when folks say God, they more often than not mean the God of the Hebrew Bible. They mean Yahweh. When someone in an Indic context says God, they can mean the Divine Mother. They can mean Vishnu. They can mean Brahman, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So tell us a bit about Sri Chinmoy's perspective or perception of God.
Well, there's one supreme reality, and it's, as the Upanishads say, it's beyond speech and mind. It's beyond human or any ordinary human knowing. This reality can assume different forms. There's no limit to the forms that he or she may assume. So you have a problem in the English language, which is that God with a capital G means what I just said. And then there's God with a small g, which, of course, in Sanskrit or Indic languages, that would be Deva. And the supreme reality, Brahman or Bhagavan, wouldn't be referred to just as Deva. But correct me if I'm wrong, and I realize people are listening who may be far more versed in these matters than I am. But Hindu tradition certainly makes a distinction between the supreme reality, in Rig Veda 10.129. It's called That One. And then it says the gods came later. You know, the devas came later after that. So Sri Chinmoy would be very clear that the one supreme reality can be formless and impersonal. It can be personal with a specific form that need not be a human-like form. Let me leave it at that for the moment. So just a moment. So cosmologically, the third chapter that's on creation speaks more of this. There is a transcendent dimension. And here we use spatial metaphors for ontology, which is a subject of great interest to me. A kind of a vertical ontological dimension is the transcendent. Transcend just means to be beyond. Well, what does it mean, beyond? Well, you know, that's a spatial metaphor, if you like. Or the universal divine is the cosmic, the horizontal dimension, if you wish. And I have mentioned a word in the book that Sri Chinmoy himself certainly never uses, and that's panentheism. So, and very, very simply put, this means that the universe but is contained within the divine. The entire universe or manifested being is inside of the divine nature, which is more than what is manifested or the creation. It exceeds it. So, and that's a very simple definition, but I think it's needed to kind of locate his account.
What does he have to say about the soul's journey? Chapter 4.
He says that in the process of reincarnation, the soul exists in the mineral world, the vegetable world, the animal world, and the human world. And through the process of reincarnation, it travels in from the forms of existence which are earlier in the, you know, planetary and biological evolution to the human state. And that's a traditional account which he affirms. But it's given an evolutionary direction that the soul doesn't go backwards.
Would you say that his philosophy is by and large Hindu or classical Hindu philosophy? Is he sort of an exegete? Is he an expounder of? Is he giving voice to Hindu philosophy, or is he innovating in some way?
First of all, I wouldn't associate him with very much with classical Indian philosophy in the sense of darshana. He doesn't give scholastic exegesis with attention to debates in classical Indian philosophy as it develops after the, let's say, epic period. His sources are, as I state in the book, especially the Upanishads and Bhagavad Gita. But there is a stream in modern Indian thought or Hinduism, and Hinduism is a contested term, as we all know. So I borrow the term stream from contemporary Judaism. I like it because it's less specific than tradition in the sense of lineage or parampara. So I would say it's a stream from Sri Ramakrishna Swami Vivekananda, Sri Aurobindo and the mother, and of course I should mention Sarada Devi and Sri Chinmoy. And so there's a family resemblance. There's certain important points, central points in common. And so Sri Chinmoy is affirming and expressing this tradition or stream. And now I'm not sure I'm answering your question, Raj, but his exposition is not speculative, and doesn't enter into debates or controversies, almost never. He simply states the position with regard to the subject at hand. And almost half of, it was very important in the book to let Sri Chinmoy speak for himself. And I would venture that practically half of the book is his words. There's a great deal of quotation. And of the quotation from his words, about half of that is poetry. And so in style, it's not a style of, or an approach of academic philosophy or of scholastic philosophy, as you would find it in any tradition, which would be, as you said, exegetical. Is this making sense?
Yes, that's making sense. What you're saying, which is apparent from one who reads the book or who knows Sri Chinmoy, is that he's not engaged in the work of sort of scholarly quibbles or of parsing out a point or weighing in on which darshana had it right. No, I understand that entirely. Mm-hmm. Now zooming out of that those philosophical quandaries, in terms of say world religion, certainly it seems that his worldview and teachings land within an Indic worldview versus, say, an Abrahamic worldview in terms of moksha, karma, samsara, his particular perspective on the divine. Yes?
In terms of the affirmation of reincarnation, that there is a state of liberation, but in Sri Chinmoy's thought, the goal of spiritual life is not liberation, just to exit from the cycle of samsara. Yes, in the respect you just said, it is Indic. Yes. There's a very interesting thing, however, which is that there's an option within Judaism to believe in reincarnation.
An option indeed, an option that is rarely taken up. you touched on a really interesting point about the goal of the cycles of rebirth, the goal of human life. Let me phrase it this way. Sri Chinmoy was very much active in the world, and there seems to be a clear favoring for world engagement in some sense. Could you say a bit more about that?
I think it's at the core of his philosophy. He was once asked, could you state your philosophy in one line? And he said, our philosophy is the acceptance of life for the transformation of life, and also for the manifestation of God's light here on earth at God's choice hour in God's own way. So the acceptance of life is for the transformation of the world through the manifestation of God's divine qualities, here referred to as God's light in the world. And those who know the teachings of Sri Aurobindo will see immediately that it's an affirmation of transformation as Sri Aurobindo expounded it at great length, so that it's not rejection of the world, but transformation of the world. And that doesn't prioritize individual. Of course, we must each strive for our own illumination. But ultimately, my own illumination is not, or liberation, those are two different things, is not the goal.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
If I can share a poem with you, this is one of my favorites.
Absolutely.
Yes. So he says, if you really care for the world, then love the world, serve the world, become the world, and do not think of your personal salvation. And for me, there's always echoes of the Bodhisattva path in Mahayana Buddhism in that statement. And he also says, to love the world is to make the world perfect. The love of the heart is the way to world transformation. The world will be transformed through love.
Could you say a little bit about his involvement with the United Nations, his work there?
Yes, thank you so much. Well, in 1970, he was actually invited by the then Secretary General U Thant, who was a Buddhist and himself practiced meditation seriously, to conduct biweekly meditations for peace at United Nations. And a group of staff members formed at the United Nations. So we had our 50th anniversary as the pandemic was starting. So we wanted to have a program. I've never worked myself directly for the UN, but I have been near the UN, you know, in the NGO, you know, non-governmental organization context a great deal. And to affirm the values stated in the Charter of the United Nations, and to bring to the fore the spiritual dimensions of the mission of the United Nations as the world organization that is trying, in spite of all challenges, to create harmony and sustainability and unity in the world. Over the years, I wrote a whole essay on this particular subject that was published in the journal Cross Currents. So my book does not actually refer to this in detail, but you know, I have written about it elsewhere. And over these years, since 1970, you could, if you lived through this as I have, that's how old I am. A growing acceptance, and the peace meditation group played its part in that, but so did other groups at the UN and U Thant himself, and everyone knows that Dag Hammarskjöld, the second Secretary General, wrote a famous book of spiritual aphorisms called Markings about his inner life. So there has been through the years an increasing interest in spirituality at the UN and meditation and spirituality. And we could talk for a long time about this, but spirituality comes as a kind of, and the interfaith process also comes as a way of including different religious traditions without becoming embroiled in the conflicts between traditions or from the standpoint of the UN getting politically entangled, you know, with this religion, that religion, some other religion. So the interfaith process and the universal dimension of spirituality, meaning, again, very simply, the interior life, contemplative practice, something that's experiential, but also will be manifested, as we were saying, in the outer world. So that's a sketch of the meditations and their purpose. And the meditations at UN would be in silence, complete silence, almost always, with maybe a very brief musical interlude. But other programs with lectures or celebrating the cultures of different countries and so forth were a separate activity from the meditations, the peace meditations themselves, which were silent meditation.
Would you mind sharing with us what called you to Sri Chinmoy? What was it about him or his philosophy that that clearly appealed to you to the point of writing this book, to the point of accepting him as a teacher? Could you say a bit about that for the audience?
Well, sure. And I've not written about this in the book, but thank you for asking. The book is not about my journey, but although it's the book I could write, you know. So I became interested in Buddhism and in particularly in Zen when I was still in high school. And I didn't take up any, my tradition of origin is actually the Episcopal Church of the USA. So I didn't take up the practice of meditation until I had graduated from college. But as I had mentioned before, I majored in philosophy. I had read a bit about Buddhism. And also, I knew I wanted to study Buddhism, and I studied Japanese while I was in college. And I went to Japan for a year. And while I was in Japan in 1968-69, I began the practice of Zen under Nakagawa Soen Roshi, a great Zen teacher of the 20th century. And I came back to New York, and I was continuing my Zen practice. And I have to say, Zen is an extremely profound path, and a path of great genius, but it's not a path of love and devotion, or it was not at that time. Zen today has changed, you know, and that's a whole other podcast that we could have, how Zen and Buddhism have changed in the last 50 years after transmission to the West. But I began to realize that there was a whole part of my spiritual nature that I was not harnessing or drawing on to make progress, and that was the side of the affections of love and devotion. And then I read the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. And I read it slowly. It took some months. And when I had finished reading it, I was a different person. And to be brief, I was seeking a teacher who would be in the body, but like Sri Ramakrishna. When I met Sri Chinmoy, I recognized that he was the teacher that I was seeking. And Sri Chinmoy was once, and I was speaking about the stream, right? Sri Chinmoy was once asked, what is the difference between your path and Sri Ramakrishna's path? And he said, well, there really isn't any. No. So, and I've tried to bring that out a bit in the book. You could point to certain differences of emphasis and tone, but there are some, like, very essential things, of course, that are the same. So I've always, this is a very, very rarely do I speak about these things. It's very personal, but I have utmost love and adoration for Sri Ramakrishna. And, you know, and so that's how I came to my teacher.
Thank you very much for being so candid and open and sharing about the passion behind this project. You know, the what so kindled your interest in this philosophy. Clearly, Indian philosophy is intended for more than intellectual speculation. It's intended for transformation. It's intended for embodiment. So that's a beautiful homage to your teacher and his teachings. Is there currently a thriving following of Sri Chinmoy? What does that currently look like?
Our community, I would say, is thriving. Our programs are continuing. He has been out of the body for 14 years, but new members are coming to our centers, to the path. And we continue our musical concerts, art exhibits. One of the things that we are known for is putting on athletic events, especially ultra running events. And I published an essay about this in Hinduism Today, sports and spirituality. You mentioned before the question, what does Sri Chinmoy bring that is new, you know, to the stream or tradition that precedes him? And I think one answer to that question is in the acceptance of the world and living in the world. Self-transcendence is such a core principle that, as I mentioned, he described his path as a path of love, devotion, and surrender. And I have sometimes, when repeating that, added self-transcendence as the fourth principle. We have the longest foot race in the world. It's a certified athletic event. It's 3,100 miles. And I can't resist mentioning it because it's about to start on September 5th. And we have 7 runners who are going to attempt that distance. One of whom is a woman, and she's done it before.
Yeah, so for our audience, say a bit about that that may not be readily apparent. Sri Chinmoy not only was prolific in his production of prose and poetry alike, he also was quite involved in physical feats, was he not?
He was an athlete his entire life. So athletics was part of life on the Sri Aurobindo ashram. And the athletic program was created by the mother, Mira Alfasa, who had been a devoted sportswoman herself in her youth in France. And she played tennis for most of her life, as some of our listeners may know. And she hiked in the Alps and so forth. And so brought to the ashram, the director of the first director of the athletics program, and this was right at the beginning of World War II, when she had given permission for children to live on the ashram because there was a war, you know, and so everything was exceptional. And then the practices changed, and children were welcomed at the ashram, and the school was now established with even with the lower grades. And so Sri Chinmoy, coming at the age of 12, entered into this athletic program, and he became a very outstanding track and field athlete. He won the trophy as the fastest runner for 12 years. He was a decathlon champion, and excelled at table tennis, volleyball. And that's part of the integral yoga, in which there is perfection of the body, acceptance of the physical, and training, cultivation of the body. But sports also develops concentration. Of course, it's a commonplace in our culture that sports builds character and teamwork. All of that we can recognize, that is fine. But it also develops concentration and fearlessness, and is a kind of and it's one of those things, like, you know, the word ascesis in Greek, we associate asceticism with denial, but ascesis means training. And it's the training of an athlete, the training of a musician, and the training of in yoga. These things are closely allied as disciplines of disciplines that develop a person in different ways.
He certainly was quite the Renaissance man, being spiritual, intellectual, artistic, athletic.
That's the integrality, the acceptance of the different venues of life.
Fascinating. Is there anything else about the book or Sri Chinmoy or the path that you wanted to share today before we close? Take your time.
I state at the end of the first chapter that it's not a book of comparison or a historical study. The book is not that long. It's under 200 pages. If it was a historical study tracing all these themes and then coming up to the present and, you know, engaging in comparison with various figures and traditions in India and elsewhere, it would double the book's length and actually make it much less useful, I believe. The book aspires to be a straightforward, unembroidered summary of Sri Chinmoy's thought. But as explained earlier, he didn't approach his expression of his philosophy like an academic philosopher. He always considered poetry as his primary vocation. And he much preferred to express himself in poetry or at least in aphorisms. Many of his lectures are just like a prose poem or a series of aphorisms. So as mentioned, he doesn't write in a scholastic style. And he never had any interest in writing a systematic theology as we find it by some great theologians, you know. And so it was my task as his disciple to find the essential statements about the different themes, God, creation, evolution, the soul's journey, love, knowledge, and to document the points that he's making over some 40 years and lay them out in a philosophically coherent and sequential way. That was what I tried to do. I did not embroider anything or spin anything. If I interjected, at any point, we might take this as meaning so-and-so, perhaps that's related to so-and-so. I tried to indicate by some turn of phrase that it's an interjection, you know. But it's supposed to be a basic work that introduces Sri Chinmoy and his thought so that others can then push off from that to do more specialized treatments, comparative studies, whatever they would like to do, or more popular studies, which some people are interested in as well. So I hope that's helpful.
Yes, certainly it reads as a distillation of his thought, organized as such. Mm-hmm. And as you say, one thought that comes to mind is good books are beginning is not endings. And so perhaps there will be some ethnographic work on a center in Toronto, perhaps. Perhaps there will be a comparison of Sri Chinmoy and various other teachers from India contemporaneous with his work. I mean, who knows?
I have written a number of other essays that are much more specialized that don't add up to a coherent book. And I'm hoping to bring those out myself in just a kind of motley collection of, like, you know, I've written one on his art and creativity. I've written one, as I mentioned, on the United Nations. I've written one on sports. And I actually just published in the Journal of Dharma Studies Sri Chinmoy's Philosophy of Nature. And that's online at the Journal of Dharma Studies. And that's his, he would refer to the transformation of the world as peace, the achievement of peace. God manifestation will give birth to peace peace defined as an inclusive, you know, state of harmony and flourishing of the whole whole creation. So within that is the harmony of ourselves with nature, the flourishing of all beings in the natural world. And so I drew out, I'm very deeply committed to this. So I drew out from all of his writings the things that he had said about the nature as he says that I should know it by heart, but that God, that nature is the universal divine. That nature is in fact part of God, and that the beauty of nature is, I know part of is not exact language. The beauty of nature is a direct revelation of the divine, and the environmental ethics flows from that. So I just published that. So I'm hoping in the next year or two to bring out the collection of the more specialized studies, and hope that will be useful to people as well. But this book is as we've just said, it's more of sort of straightforward philosophical exposition.
Well, we'll have to have you back on the podcast when the collection's out.
Well, thank you kindly.
And thank you for appearing today.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Raj, for having me. It means a lot.
Oh, you're very welcome. For those of you listening, we have been speaking with Kusmita Peterson on her brand new 2021 Lexington book, The Philosophy of Sri Chinmoy. Until next time, stay safe, stay sane, keep listening, keep reading, and keep contemplating the philosophy of the ancients. Take care.